Hey everyone, what's going on? Welcome to a brand new edition of the Sam Bissell Podcast on the Ambiguous Podcast Solutions. And right now we bring you the latest and greatest going on around the world of Hollywood. Hope everyone had a wonderful weekend. Hope everyone had a happy Father's Day, a happy Juneteenth, and is ready for the week ahead. A lot of stuff that I want to talk about on the podcast today. I'm going to be getting into some big trailers that literally just kicked off in the last 2 days to start off the week. I'm also going to be getting into the first reactions for the new Mission Impossible film, Dead Reckoning Part 1. Also, a major film that is coming out in the next couple years just moved up its release date, so we're going to get into all that and so much more. But the first thing that I do want to talk about on the podcast today is, of course, what I like to do every single start to the week, whether it is, again, on a Monday or Tuesday, and that is, of course, recapping the weekend box office. And usually when it comes to the box office, I like to kind of think of the glass half full, think a little bit of the good things that can come out of it if it's not a great weekend. But unfortunately for this weekend, there's no way to sugarcoat what happened. But when you look at the year of the box office so far, and you look at the films that have come out pretty much throughout each of the weekends so far in 2023, this weekend, as of now, has to be, or this past weekend rather, has to be the worst weekend the box office has had this year and probably the last 2 years or so since we've kind of gotten back under the feet under us and under the box office due to the COVID-19 pandemic. This is probably the worst post-pandemic box office weekend in the recent years, and the reason for that is because the major films that came out this past weekend flopped major heavy. And usually when it comes to the weekend box office, I don't like to think of it, again, as I like to think of kind of glass half full. If a film doesn't do well its opening weekend, then it can still do well in its subsequent weekends. It can still do well in its second, third, fourth weekend ahead. And sometimes you don't need to have a big opening to really mount a heavy campaign, or it's not a make or break when it's the opening weekend. I mean, just earlier this year, late last year, when Avatar The Way of Water had a very rocky opening weekend, but still was able to find its footing and wanted to be one of the highest grossing films of all time. Unfortunately, sometimes some films do need to start big and still hold throughout the coming weekends. And with the films that came out in the box office, unfortunately, that did not turn out to be the case, sadly, as the films that did come out were some of the most anticipated films of the summer, of the year for some people, and they really, really underperformed. And that does not spell well, I think, for their overall run moving forward. So we're going to kick it all off and, of course, talk about the number one film of this weekend, which is the box office champion, which is really, I think, the only thing it has going for it in terms of its box office run post its release. And that, of course, is a new DC film, The Flash, which grossed $55.7 million this opening weekend. So far, it has made $64 million domestically, $74 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $138 million at the box office. And this is not the kind of opening that DC, Warner Brothers Discovery, I think, had in mind for The Flash. This is a film that for Warner Brothers was probably arguably their biggest mark of the 2023 calendar for them this year. This is the film that a lot of people were anticipating. This is a film that was going to kind of reset the DC universe, especially with everything coming forward with James Gunn and Peter Safran. This was going to give us two Batman. You had Ben Affleck returning as the Caped Crusader, and also the return of one of the classic Batman in Michael Keaton. You also had a new Supergirl, or a Supergirl, come in live action with Sasha Kaye. You had all these kind of links and surprises and cameos and all these things that were coming in, and it was in the prime summer movie slot in around the middle of June, which is still when you get a lot of schools letting out and people are out and about and enjoying the summertime. And this is one of the primary spots to hoist a summer movie season film, really a blockbuster. And it really heavily underperformed, as it even came in way below the initial estimates within its projections, which a lot of third-party exhibitioners had this coming in at around $70 million, and it wasn't even able to top that. It wasn't even able to even almost scratch $70 million in its initial projections. It wasn't able to come in to even the opening weekend of Black Adam, which was kind of the one of the first black eyes in this new era of the DC universe with Dwayne Johnson, and that film grosses $67 million. And looking at it now, that looks like to be a huge opening weekend compared to what The Flash and even Shazam Fury of the Gods did when that film opened up to $30 million. And its overall box office run for that film was disastrous. And it seems like The Flash is unfortunately going to follow in those footsteps. And again, usually when you look at opening weekends, even for a film like this, maybe you can think about, oh, it's off to a rocky start. Maybe it can get going in the subsequent weeks. But there's a lot of evidence to theorize that maybe this film just isn't going to catch on. And when you look at that, a big part of it is because of the cinema score that it got, which was a B, not a B plus, not an A minus, not even an A, a B. And when it comes to these blockbuster films, you need to come in between that A to B plus range. If you go in anything below that, that's not good. That is a sign that not a lot of audience members were interested in your film, didn't enjoy the film coming out of their experience of it. And what that usually means is that the word of mouth going around for this film, when other people are asking, hey, I was thinking about seeing The Flash, should I go see it? And the person that might recommend or not recommend seeing it might say, well, you know what, it was okay, or you can wait for it to come on streaming on Max, or you don't need to go see it. They could really steer this film to really, really underperform throughout its run in these next couple of weeks. And that's not what Warner Brothers needs right now. That's not what DC needs at this particular moment in time. And I think this does not bode well for DC moving forward. Not in its new phase with James Gunn and Peter Safran and the reboot that they're going to do, but I'm just really kind of talking about for the rest of 2023 right now. And looking at Aquaman, The Lost Kingdom, and Blue Beetle, what does this mean? Does this mean that really people are not interested in these characters anymore in this era, and they're just ready to kind of move on to a more cohesive universe that just makes a lot more sense than what's going on right now? Could it be that maybe people are done with the multiversal storyline? There's a lot of that kind of going around right now. I mean, just within the summer season, you had Spider-Verse going on, and that is very much more of a cohesive multiverse film. The MCU is dealing in the multiverse right now, so people just might be multiversed out right now. And when you go see this film, you don't want, audience members might not want to deal with that right now, might not want to see that film at this particular moment in time, especially when this film was conceived years ago and the multiverse was kind of this new hot thing that was going on. You had Spider-Man in No Way Home and Loki and all of these different things going in with the multiverse, that maybe now that these films are coming out and these projects are coming out with the multiverse, people might just be tired out at this particular moment in seeing those kinds of films right now. Then I think another big question into what really kind of went wrong with this movie and its box office performance was this film overhyped? And I'm one of those people that might have done it as well, where this was one of my most anticipated films of the year. I thought that the nostalgia factor could really help this film boost itself, especially with the return of Michael Keaton. And I think myself and a bunch of others really oversold that and thought that was going to be a huge driving force. Could it have been that whole Ezra Miller controversy was a factor? I think the people that are kind of within the bubble that I'm in terms of the movie, entertainment, TV industry, that follow all the news and the headlines, we might have known about it, I think, a little bit, and that might have affected people that are in the know. But for the general audience members that didn't know what that was, I don't think they were necessarily attracted or detracted to those things that they had no idea what it was. I just think that when you see the name The Flash, I think it just doesn't carry the same weight as a Batman or even a Superman or a Spider-Man or an Iron Man, Captain America. Those are the names that people, I think, just are synonymous with when it comes to the comic book genre right now. And even though The Flash might work well in a Justice League film, and maybe if The Flash came out 2 years, kind of like what Aquaman did, where Aquaman was a billion-dollar hit, that film came out a year after Justice League, maybe if The Flash came out in 2019 or even in a COVID-less 2020, maybe that film does a lot better than what it did right now. Or really, if you had not seen Justice League or even Zack Snyder's Justice League, were you really interested in seeing a Flash movie? Now, I'm somebody who liked the Flash film. I didn't think it was the greatest comic book film of all time, but I can understand where maybe audience members just were not interested in it right now. And I just think it goes to show that for the superhero comic book genre, maybe I think it just goes to show over some of these mishaps between Shazam and the Flash and even Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, if a film isn't able to deliver on that great comic book level that people know this genre can produce, are they going to go see a middle of the road comic book movie? And I think the answer so far this year proves that that is just not the case right now. I think for audience members, do they care about these films? I think they do, but they're not going to go see a film like this when you got a film like Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse out right now, or Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, where those films are a lot better than The Flash. They're just going to go see those films that they know they're going to have a good time with. Whereas with this movie, sure, you might not have a nostalgia factor, and especially if you're a little bit older and you know the Michael Keaton Batman, but other than that, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot that really attracts you to this movie overall. And whether Ezra Miller, if they were really in trouble or not, whether they could do press or not do press, I don't really think that was a huge enough factor moving forward. I just think that people weren't into this film, and I think, which we'll get into with more of the box office, is it's a very crowded marketplace right now. People are picking their poison for what they want to go see in theaters, and this just didn't hit on a lot of people's radar. And I think that's the unfortunate really solution and answer to why The Flash didn't do so well. And I think the same thing can be said about what happened to the number two film of this weekend, which was the second big release, is the new Disney Pixar film Elemental, which did $29.6 million. It made $29.6 million in its domestic gross so far, or rather in its updated tally, $33.3 million. It made $15.9 million internationally for a $49.2 million worldwide at the box office. And again, it just goes to show that for some reason these films are not doing it. With Elemental, as much as I love this movie and I love what Pixar does, and to me it's a crime that this film probably is going to be a major bomb for the company, I think people should go see this film. But unfortunately, the box office isn't adding up to that. When you look at the statistics for where Elemental lands in the pecking order of Pixar films, if you take out the initial feature film debut of Pixar Animation, which is the original Toy Story film, which is in regards to one of the greatest animated films of all time, and in some people's minds, it's one of their favorite films of all time, period. If you take that out of the equation, it is technically the lowest grossing opening weekend in the history of Pixar animated films. It is even below the second feature film of Pixar, which was A Bug's Life, which came in at around $33.2 million. So for Elemental, this is not a very good sign. And the film that it's even below that one, you look at 2015's The Good Dinosaur, which came in around $39.1 million. That's not good for a Pixar film. And then the other one, you can really kind of chalk it up to an excuse to why it didn't do well, and that is the 2020 Pixar film Onward, which came in right as kind of the COVID-19 pandemic was really rearing its ugly head around the world, and a lot of theaters were shutting down. People were a little hesitant. So that film has the built-in excuse of the pandemic really starting to come to full force within the time frame that film came in release, as it grossed only $39.1 million, the same as Good Dinosaur, within its opening weekend. So for Elemental, it doesn't have that excuse, and it makes the opening weekend for Lightyear last year, which in its overall box office run is considered to be a disastrous return on that investment last year. It makes that $50 million opening, or I think it was $50 to $70 million around there, it made that opening weekend look like it's one of the great openings for an animated film in the last couple of years, which it's not. And especially for a studio like Pixar, it's very, very concerning, and it brings up questions of what does this mean for the animation studio moving forward, especially when it comes to originality, because they do have films coming out which are sequels to some of their big hits over the last decade plus, between Inside Out 2 coming out. They, of course, have another Toy Story movie coming out as well, which Toy Story 4 in 2019 did over $1 billion. Same thing with the third film when it came out in 2010. It was a $1 billion hit. So for this, for Pixar, what does this mean moving forward? Was it really the fact that streaming played a big part into the audience's mindset in seeing a Pixar film, where they can just wait on Disney Plus? They don't have to go to the theaters, and especially if you're a family of four, you have two kids, two parents, which is a lot of money to spend at the theaters when you account for the ticket prices, for the concessions, handling your kids in a movie theater, especially if they're a little bit on the younger side, is that worth the hassle instead of having it more in a controlled environment to see these movies at home instead of in theaters? That's a lot that Pixar has to kind of take into the equation, really. And again, I really hope that this isn't not the end of Pixar. I don't think this is the doomsday protocol for them in terms of, is this the end of the studio? No, but I think it is very concerning where this isn't the top tier studio financially that it used to be, where you never, ever, ever put a film in the middle of June right around where Pixar usually puts one of their films, and you had a good idea that this was a film that they had a lot of confidence in and that they would really, really want to see do well both financially and critically. And that would be the case for a lot of these films. I mean, you look at Up, WALL-E in 2008, 2009, Toy Story 3, of course, Incredibles, Incredibles 2, Brave. Those films did very, very well at the box office. They didn't make $1 billion, but they made $600-700 million in the box office and were able to be big enough hits that it would justify moving and doing these things moving forward, and that audiences wanted to see these original type of films, along with, of course, mixing in the sequels and bringing back characters that everyone beloved or really holds dear to their hearts. Is it going to become a question of, is Disney going to rely more on the hits than the originals right now to kind of bolster up the animation studio right now and kind of keep it going? That's going to be a big question moving forward. And I think another big question that Elemental services right now within animation, the two big hits for the genre this year are Super Mario Brothers, which is the highest grossing film of the year, over $1 billion, and then Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse is doing great money at the box office, which we'll talk about in just a bit. But does that, the things that those two have in common is that they're based on IP. They're based on characters and worlds that people know. So for Pixar, again, is it the case that for the family market right now, are they only going to take their kids to see animated films of characters and worlds that they know? Is that what the market is right now? Because also another film that did very well in the animation spot, from kind of transitioning from last year to this year early on in the year, was Puss in Boots: The Last Wish. And of course, that is from the Shrek world, and Puss in Boots is a very well-known character within that universe. So is that really the trend that we're going with right now, where everything, really the big hits, are from IP driven properties right now, and it's not really from these original films and new characters and new worlds? Is that the direction that we're going in? And if that's the case, how are companies like Pixar, who thrive on originality, not just in terms of storytelling, but innovation on the animated scale in terms of creating new technology and new ways of showcasing animation, what does that mean for them? Are they going to have to scale back on the $200 million budgets and then some? So I think there's going to be a lot of questions moving forward with Elemental, and also with The Flash, and it brings up the studios. And again, for DC, it's more the fact of, where does it go from here? And but you know where it's going with the reboot. But for Pixar, it's, what does this company do in the next couple of years? And they don't have any other film coming out for the rest of the year. So really, they have a little less than a year to kind of regroup, as Elio is their next film coming out next year, which is in March, and then in the summer movie season of next year, right around this same exact time period, is when Inside Out 2 is coming out. So is it going to be a case where Elio will do okay money, but then Inside Out 2 is going to be the bankable film that Disney needs that will bring in that money that they're hoping Pixar can continue to do? It's going to be a wait and see approach, but I'm very curious to see what the new direction is going to be for Pixar moving forward. But again, it's very unfortunate because I love Elemental. It's one of my favorite films of the year so far, and so I'm hoping that more people do still go see that film and support it and are somehow able to make it seem a little bit better than the actual route of this film is going right now with its box office legs. Then to move into the next couple of spots on the list, going in at number three is the number two film from last weekend, and that of course is Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, which grossed an additional $27.2 million at the box office and now has made $279 million domestically, $209 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $493 million at the box office. Again, other than Guardians of the Galaxy right now, this is probably the biggest hit of the summer movie season right now. I mean, Spider-Man is just ruling it right now in the month of June, and it is a film that, again, people are still going to see right now. I think the hype for the film has not died down. The legs are there for this movie, so I think it's going to have a very, very good rest of the run as we kind of go through the rest of the summer movie season, especially in the back half of the season where you have films like Indiana Jones and Joyride and Oppenheimer and Barbie and Mission Impossible. Once we get more and more of these films in there, I still think Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse is really going to stand out and do well in its run. Then coming in at number four this weekend was the reigning champion the weekend prior, and that was Transformers Rise of the Beast, which made an additional $20.7 million at the box office. It has now made $101 million domestically, $174 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $278 million at the box office. And last weekend, I thought Transformers Rise of the Beast got off to a very good start. $60 million, not too shabby, especially coming off of the last two films, which were more of the lower end grossing opening weekends of the Transformers franchise. This was not a return to form from the original Michael Bay films, but this was showing that there might be some interest. Well, it seemed like maybe the interest was only in the fans that came out opening weekend, as this weekend Transformers did what you shouldn't do from your opening weekend to your sophomore weekend, which is take a more than 50 to 60% dive between opening and your sophomore weekend, making right now the exact numbers that it came in 66% from opening to sophomore weekend, and that is not a very good sign for the legs of this movie. I think that was also a showcase and was a big testament to the summer overall so far, and one of the big storylines for the summer season is the fact that it lost basically all of its premium level format screens, IMAX, Dolby, 3D really, to films like The Flash and Elemental. And I don't know if those theaters might have held this film up or if it would have still taken that nosedive, but even though this film has some good buzz around it, the initial fans that wanted to go see the film did go see it. And again, the success of a film needs to predicate on the fact that word of mouth gets out there. People go see this film multiple times. New people go see it. And that's just not the case with this film. So even though I want to see more from this franchise moving forward and the way that they ended Rise of the Beast gets me excited for the future, and I'm hoping that future comes to fruition, this is not a good sign for its overall healthy legs moving forward. And it's going to have to really rebound after this weekend to really make up some serious ground and do very well if it wants to become a profitable film for Paramount Pictures moving forward. Then coming in at number five this weekend is the one and only The Little Mermaid, which grossed another $11 million at the box office. It has now made $253 million domestically. Internationally, it comes out to $212 million for a worldwide total of $468 million. Now, the thing with The Little Mermaid is it's doing fine. It's not gangbusters, unfortunately. It's not doing the numbers that its comp is doing, which was Aladdin back in 2019. And I think because of the expectations placed on this film, I put it on it there it as well. I thought this film was going to be a $1 billion hit. And clearly, the international market is not helping this film whatsoever. Even domestically, what would have maybe even been getting it to maybe $400 million at the box office just doesn't seem realistic at this point. And that those international numbers are really, really killing it right now with just around that same number. The percentage is really kind of in line with one another, and that's why it might not even hit $500 million. It'll be lucky if it hits $500 million and going over $500 million worldwide. So for The Little Mermaid, I think this is also another one where it could really actually end up being a loss. Not a huge loss, not like a bomb, but it could very well end up being a minor loss for the studio, where in the end, they were hoping for one of this to be one of their bigger successes, not just of the summer, but of the entirety of 2023. And I think for Disney right now, between Little Mermaid not doing so hot, Elemental bombing its opening weekend, it's really... And Guardians of the Galaxy is really its only big hit right now this summer, which opened up the season back in May. A lot of pressure comes down to Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny for Disney right now, because even though that they're at over $1 billion, some of their films haven't been doing so hot this year at this particular moment in time as we get to the halfway mark of the year. And for Indy, the opening weekend numbers are not looking good, and that's another one where I thought that could maybe hit $1 billion, and that's even scaring me a little bit right now. So that Disney is putting a lot of their going to put a lot of their bubbles, their beads into the bucket of Indiana Jones. And of course, they still have the Haunted Mansion in late July, but I don't think that's what they're hoping to be their big film of the summer. I think they were hoping for these films in May and June to be the one that carry them. And it's all going to come down to see what Indiana Jones does, and they can maybe go into the second half of the year feeling a little bit confident. But for The Little Mermaid, again, not doing horrifically, but given the expectations on the film, a little bit of a disappointment going into its fifth weekend at the box office. Then moving on to number six this weekend was The Blackening, which grossed an additional $6 million at the box office. It has made $7 million now worldwide and domestically at the box office as well. Then to round out the rest of the top 10, at number seven is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. It's made an additional $5.2 million at the box office. It has now made $345 million domestically, $476 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $821 million at the box office. And then coming in at number eight is The Boogeyman, which grossed $3.6 million at the box office. It has now made $32 million domestically, $18 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $52 million at the box office. And then coming in at number nine is Fast 10, which grossed an additional $2 million. It has now made $142 million domestically, $534 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $677 million. Then speaking of Fast 10, with those numbers, again, that kind of like Little Mermaid, isn't, I mean, given the budget, which was one of the most expensive budgets in movie history, you could look at this as kind of a big bomb in the fact that it might not be able to recuperate that money. And the fact that, given that F9 came out in a pandemic late in 2021, it might not even hit the $700+ million that film made 2 years ago, which is very, very worrisome for this franchise right now. And the fact that Universal decided to put this film out, I believe it was last weekend on VOD, or two weekends ago really on VOD, and already kind of start getting its home video release kind of marketing and scheduling going, does not bode well for how they feel given the performance of this film over the last month or so. So not a lot of confidence in this one, and I'm very curious to see what they do with the second part of this film, the fact that they're bringing back Hobbs again for his own standalone movie. Are those budgets going to come down? Are they going to go up because of the cast and what they do with those movies? It's going to be very curious to see. But I don't think this bodes well for what Universal wants to do with the franchise moving forward, because it is still one of the more lucrative ones, and I think they're going to want to kind of position it to have success and not have these kind of big failures. Because if this film had a $150 million budget or even a little bit lower, I think this would be a manageable win for them. Not a huge one, but if you get to $600, $700 million plus, and you almost equal what – F9 did and you had that kind of budget, I think you would be okay. I think if the fact that it might not even hit it or barely hit that number from F9 and it has this budget, that's not what you want. You needed to hit almost $1 billion for this to be justifiable with that budget before even marketing, and I don't think that's going to be the case with this one. And then to round out the top 10 this weekend, of course, is the new Wes Anderson film, Asteroid City, which made $840,000 at just 6 screenings. It also made $1 million internationally for a worldwide total of $2.7 million. And the big takeaway for Asteroid City this weekend, again, it only performed at 6 theaters. It's going to have a wider rollout this upcoming weekend. But with the $140 million per theater average, it also broke a record that was high standing from 2016 onward until now, where it is Asteroid City is now the highest per theater average weekend since La La Land opened to $176,000 for a per theater average of that amount when it came out in 2016. So usually this is the theaters and the markets that Wes Anderson kind of caters to. It's the big cinephile areas, the big theaters within both coasts, West and East, and it did well for itself. But again, usually when you see these numbers, the big question is it going to be able to attract more theater goers to see these movies as the theater count gets higher and higher as the weekends continue to go on, as the film slowly rolls out to the wider world and the country in the next couple of weeks. That's going to be really the big question moving forward. And then I just, one other thing that I want to end on when it comes to the box office this weekend, I'm very curious to see this weekend overall, given the bombs opening weekend for The Flash and Elemental and the worrisome second weekend drop for Transformers and seeing the performances of The Little Mermaid and Fast 10, what does this mean for the rest of the summer season moving forward in the box office? Are a lot of people going to have to kind of readjust their projections for some of these films? Like for Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, are those projections going to be adjusted a little bit more? Is it going to be more worrisome than confident? With Mission Impossible 7, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of shakiness. I think that one is on solid ground right now. It's just going to be more of a question of, again, with the theater screenings between IMAX and Dolby and the premiums, is Mission Impossible going to be okay without those moving forward once Oppenheimer gets its hand, especially on the IMAX screenings when it starts on July 21st? And then same thing with Oppenheimer and Barbie. How are those films going to do against each other? And then going into August, I mean, Blue Beetle, how is that DC film going to perform? Can anyone expect the film to even perform well if The Flash didn't even do well? If Shazam 2, which was a sequel to a modestly hit film in 2019, not do well? Is there any chance for Blue Beetle? So I'm very curious to see what the initial or the rejiggering of expectations and projections are going to be as we move forward in the second half of the summer, this summer season, really. And I think when you don't have the IMAX screenings and the premium level screenings for a couple weekends for a movie, I think it's going to hurt. And I think this month of June, even though it's a huge month for movies, I think it's hurting the overall performance for a lot of these films because they don't have the premium level of screenings. I think Spider-Man could be doing way better right now, even better than it's doing now. And it's already a success if it had 2 to 3 weeks with those premium level screenings to itself. And then it goes to The Flash, which has it for 2 weeks. Then Indiana Jones might have it for a weekend or two before Mission Impossible. Then maybe Mission Impossible can have it for a couple weeks before Oppenheimer comes out. There's just not enough space right now. And I know it's more of the pipeline right now because this is just the way that schedule rung itself out with the post-production kind of movement that these films were kind of having within their pipeline. And it just seems like right now it's just very crowded and these films just aren't able to perform. So I think the level that some of them might be able to. Now, that's not to say that Flash would have performed better or somehow, God forbid, worse than it did right now if it had those weeks. But I just think that this is a very, very heavy summer season, and the performances for some of them, not all of them, some of them are being hindered because of the access to some of these bigger screens that they're not able to get to right now. But overall, guys, what did you think about this weekend at the box office? Let me know down below and give your overall thoughts and let me know what you think about it. And just to kind of go through it one more time from 10 to 1 again. Number 10 was Asteroid City. Number 9 was Fast 10. Number 8 was The Boogeyman. Number 7 was Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. Number 6 was The Blackening. Number 5 was The Little Mermaid. Number 4 was Transformers Rise of the Beast. Number 3 was Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Number 2 was Elemental. And the new box office champion this weekend, of course, was The Flash. So let me know what you guys think about it down below and leave your thoughts. And now I'm going to be moving on to some other movie news going on around the world in Hollywood. And the thing that I want to continue on with talking about is in the world of movie news is the trending trailers that are going on right now. And there are two big ones that came out in the last couple of days. Yesterday was one of the big comic book films that is set to come out later this year. And it's going to be set within the live-action Sony Spider-Man spider spin-off characters that Sony has been doing the last couple of years. And the latest one that they have on the docket is Kraven the Hunter, which is directed by J.C. Kandor. If you've ever seen films such as Margin Call, highly recommend a film like that. That's the director that came to this film. It's also got a very good cast, such as Aaron Taylor-Johnson leading the way as Kraven. You also have Academy Award winner Ariana DeBose. You have Frank Heigner, if you ever seen The White Lotus, specifically season one. That's where you know him from. Alessandro Nivola, you have Chris Abbott, and of course, the legendary Australian himself in Russell Crowe. And this is one that I was actually kind of curious about. This one aired some footage at CinemaCon earlier in the year, and I liked what I heard about it, the fact that it was actually going to be rated R, and it's going to be kind of the first Sony set Spider-Man film or Spider-Verse film to be rated R. Got me excited, and I was, and especially with Kraven, it fits that mold. This is a guy who's a hunter. He's somebody who's aggressive and brutal when he wants to be. It made sense, and watching the trailers, because there were two, there was a Green Band and a Red Band trailer. Green Band didn't impress me that much, but the Red Band trailer, where we're going to get all that R-rated flavorness, really actually did it for me more so than the Green Band. And even though there are some silly comic book things that happen, I think the sequences where in the very beginning you see him running through the streets of London was ridiculous, but I love the aspects where you see him kind of go hand-to-hand combat with guys in jeeps and vans, and he's slicing necks and setting off bear traps and decapitating heads, basically. And then you see him, of course, just bite off a guy's nose and just spit it out. That's the kind of R-rated grittiness and brutality that I wanted in a Kraven the Hunter film. So it was actually saved by those brutal segments, and I'm hoping that's just not in the it's not just in the trailer, but there's more to it than just that in the movie itself. Other things that really impressed me about the trailer, Russell Crowe, I mean, even in a film like this, even if the film stinks, I just can't see him doing a bad day's worth of work, really. So he seems like he's going to be an awesome, like, a-hole kind of father. And he's actually more of a Kraven than even Aaron Taylor-Johnson to me. And that kind of goes into some of the issues that I actually have with the character overall. And I'm somebody who is fine with a film taking liberties with a character. I'm somebody who's not really beholden to how somebody might be translated from one medium to another medium. As long as they kind of represent that character, I'm fine with it. But with Kraven, I was fine with the costume design, the look of him. That didn't matter to me. The one thing that really did annoy me a little bit, though, and I think is a huge factor to who makes Kraven is actually his accent. And the fact that Russell Crowe has the accent, but somehow the Kraven character doesn't, this doesn't make sense to me. And I don't know if that's an artistic choice. I don't know if that's Aaron Taylor-Johnson not wanting to do the accent, or maybe J.C. Kandor just said, you know what, we don't have to do it, we'll just do it another way. I don't know. And to me, I would honestly rather Russell Crowe be Kraven at this point, because he just seems like he embodies that kind of brutal character more than I think what Aaron Taylor-Johnson does. And I'm somebody who likes what his work recently. I was a big fan of what he did alongside Brad Pitt and Brian Tyree Henry in Bullet Train last year, and I can see why Sony wanted to get in bed with this guy again and make him the lead of this film. He's got that charisma, but there's just something, there's a brutal aspect of Aaron Taylor-Johnson, I feel like, that's missing a little bit. I'm hoping it's just the way that the trailer is put together, and the way that he's actually on in the movie in full is a lot better than I'm seeing him right now. So we'll see how this all goes, but I feel like if you're a fan of these kind of Sony Spider-Man films right now, it's kind of like a roller coaster. You get the great with the Spider-Verse films into and across the Spider-Verse, which are just Academy level great movies overall. It'll be on a lot of top 10 end of the year list for people. Then you get something like Kraven the Hunter or Morbius. And I think for Sony, when they're not doing the Spider-Verse films, I feel like they're trying to chase after live-action Spider-Man on their own. Because of the deal that they have with Marvel, they can't do Spider-Man on their own, really. And the only other options they have is working with these side characters. And they struck lightning in a bottle once, really. Well, twice, kind of, with the two Venom films. But those are Venom. Venom is, I think, popular enough that he can stand on his own. People recognize that as one of the more formidable Spider-Man villains, really. And you have a great actor embodying him in Tom Hardy. I just think that when you have a film like Morbius or Kraven, those are not kind of the A-list villains that you can do on your own, really. It's not like a Venom or a Joker where you know those villains on their own, not just associated with their counterpart hero. Kraven, if you were to put Kraven in a Spider-Man film, that would be great. He would get great notoriety, but on his own, I just don't think that's really going to work. And the same thing for a Madame Web film if it comes out next year. I don't know how that film is going to do, because who the heck knows who Madame Web is unless it's associated with Spider-Man. And maybe that film is associated with Spider-Man, and maybe Kraven is somehow associated with Spider-Man, and not just the fact that spiders are coming down to him and it seems like he has some kind of arachnophobia to spiders and hinting at his foe in Spider-Man. I don't know how they're going to play all that out, but again, there were some aspects of the trailer that I really enjoyed, the brutality of it. I hope they really lean in on that more so than anything else. And then there were the goofy comic book trends that I think come with these live-action Sony films not named Spider-Man, and of course not their animated films in the Spider-Verse films overall as well. So we'll see where this one lands. It's coming out on October 6th of this year, so we'll see how it's able to do against some competition. But again, I'm not really holding my breath in, and I'm hoping this film is good, but wouldn't be shocked if it A, turns out to be a big stinky poo for a lot of people, and if it does stinky poo at the box office this season. But again, I'm hoping to be wrong, but we'll see where that leads. The last trailer that I want to talk about today is actually for a film that I was already looking forward to, but somehow it exceeded my expectations and actually surprised me in where it was going. And that is the trailer for the film Challengers, which is directed by Luca Guadagnino. If you know his stuff, he of course directed Call Me By Your Name with Timothée Chalamet and Armie Hammer. And then just last year, he did Bones, or not last year, it was the year before in 2021, he did the film with Taylor Russell and Timothée Chalamet, Bones and All, which was a great, great love story film with cannibalism. And somehow Luca was able to make that a beautiful film somehow, with the horror and romance that all came with it. And so he's back into the feature film fray once again, this time in the world of tennis, and he's got three great young up-and-comers and one true superstar in Zendaya and, of course, Mike Feist from West Side Story, and Josh O'Connor, who played King Charles in The Crown. And basically the following synopsis for this one is that following a losing streak, the wife and coach of a Grand Slam champion signs him up for a challenger event where he will face off against her former lover. And I remember reading the synopsis for this one, and it very much seemed like the kind of Luca film that he would do, where it's set within this world, and it's a love story set within all these other things that he's trying to do, like Bones and All was, like Call Me By Your Name was. And so I was expecting it to kind of be what I expect Luca films to be, which are more slow, more character-oriented, and it's kind of set against the backdrop of something, but it's very more quiet and somber. Seeing the trailer for this one, it was a high-flying energy vessel. I mean, this one was moving at a rapid pace than anything else that I had seen Luca do in his films. And now maybe the trailer is one thing and the film is something else entirely and fits more of the tone that I know Luca to kind of do. But I'm excited to see this, and I'm excited to see him do something a little bit different in terms of tone. When you think about the story and the characters, that definitely fits into what he does as a writer, as a director, in the films that he wants to create. But the tone of it and the look of it is kind of the same as well. But the way that it feels, it just has this faster, quicker pace. And somebody even put it on Twitter, and I agree with them, this actually might have some commercial appeal to it. I think the fact that this is coming out right around September, which is when the US Open is happening, you have Zendaya, who is, I think, a true superstar and could really kind of drive in, bunch the seats, and whatever she's in, I think you could get people to go see this film. And I think this has a really good cast involved with it as well, that it could really actually turn out to be somewhat of a commercial fare, really, in some way. Not saying it's going to make $500 million at the box office, it could, but it could make $100, $200 million, and it could be more of a bigger film than we know Luca Guadagnino films to actually be when they come out. And of course, because of everyone involved, this one is probably going to be going on the film festival circuit and will probably be getting some Academy Awards praise and buzz as that season begins to kind of take shape and form. But I'm really excited about this film. I was already looking forward to it, and the trailer didn't shock me in terms of what I was expecting it to be in terms of the story and the characters, but the tone of it really surprised me, and it got me even somehow more excited to see this movie. So I'm really looking forward to it. Again, it comes out on September 15th, and I'm hoping people go see this film as well. So what did you guys think about the two trailers that came out so far this week, in Kraven the Hunter and Challengers? Which one was your favorite? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And then moving on to some other movie news that I want to talk about going on right now. It was already a big start to the major week with these trending trailers coming out, but another big thing that happened this weekend were the first reactions to the latest in the Mission Impossible franchise, in Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, which had its world premiere in Rome yesterday. You had Tom Cruise, Hayley Atwell, Christopher McQuarrie, Plum Clementeve, Simon Pegg, Rebecca Ferguson. Everyone mostly associated with that cast and crew were there for the worldwide premiere, and leave it up to Tom Cruise to go in Rome, shut down some of the more iconic venues of Rome, and host the world premiere there, as only Tom Cruise can do, in amazing fashion. And alongside of it, there were the first big reactions to this film, and this is a film that is one of my most anticipated films of the year. It's actually number 2 on my list. I think for a lot of people, it was on their most anticipated of 2023, between what Tom Cruise did last year with Top Gun Maverick, and then even all the way back in 2018, where he created one of the great action films of the decade in Mission Impossible Fallout. These Mission Impossible movies just somehow keep getting better and better and better and crazier and crazier and crazier, which each and every single one of the stunts. And of course, in this one, you have the fact that Tom Cruise is handcuffed to Hayley Atwell, and they're zooming around in multiple cars in the streets of Rome. And of course, the big stunt of this one is the fact that Tom Cruise basically motorcycles off a mountain and jumps and parachutes on his own, and that is, yes, actually him doing it. And it's all those things that you look forward to seeing in these films, and that the authenticity that they just bring to them is just truly bar none exceptional and one of a kind. So there was a lot of hype going into these films, and of course this is one of the kind of the next big blockbusters coming out that people are looking forward to in the summer movie season. And finally we have some of the reactions in line for Dead Reckoning Part 1, and these are some of the initial thoughts that people had after seeing the film. And the first one that I want to read off of is from Collider itself and Perry Nemiroff, who said, "Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 is another winner for the franchise. Yet again, the production value is through the roof, with some of the most well-defined and exhilarating set pieces photographed in ways that truly make you feel like you're in the middle of the action. The emphasis on capturing things in camera makes a huge difference, and you can feel it. Also, really dug the mission this time around and how the technology thereafter factors into the characters' individual arcs. Tom Cruise is A+ as always, and Rebecca Ferguson continues to be a favorite, but franchise newcomer Hayley Atwell wound up being the major standout for me. She can do it all. Action, comedy, a capable hero in many respects while trying to get her sea legs in others. One of the most captivating performances / arcs, and just a hugely enjoyable character to watch. She's got a scene with Tom that involves a Fiat 500 that truly had me in tears. I was laughing so much. One more set piece shout out. There's a particular scene within the sequence on the train that had my jaw on the floor. 2 hours and 43 minutes I will happily watch over and over again." Then we have another tweet coming at us from our good friend who's always joined the podcast and Fandango's Eric Davis, who had this to say about the film: "I had the absolute best time watching Mission Impossible, an impeccably made action film that does not stop entertaining. Each action sequence is long, crazy, and intense. The story is big and sprawling, but I like how it felt complete and left you dying for what comes next. I watched Mission Impossible in a Dolby house, and damn, that sound on this thing is incredible. Favorite parts are the Rome chase and the train sequence. Biggest scene stealer goes to Plum Clementeve, who plays a wicked villain with a cool arc, Palm having a great summer. Then moving on to some other tweets that came out this past Monday. Of course, another one coming from comicbook.com's very own Brandon Davis, who said, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 is phenomenal on the action front, especially in the first hour. Haley Atwell steals every scene. The villain cliffhanger and runtime didn't blow me away, but the rest is wildly entertaining and brilliantly filmed. It's solid. And some of the other ones real quick before we close out here, the other one coming from Steve Weintraub over at Collider. This is what he had to say about the film. Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning is incredible. The fastest 2 hour and 30 minute movie I've ever seen in a long time. One of the best films I've seen this year, and Tom Cruise has done it again. Demands to be seen on the biggest screen. Cannot recommend this movie enough. Big surprise was how much I loved Hayley Atwell in the film. I've always been a fan, but she is a fantastic addition to the franchise and is a huge part of the movie. And then one more that I'm going to read off here comes to us from Jermaine Lucier, who had this to say about the film. Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 is fantastic. Dynamite, timely story, excellent new characters, huge variety of action, and a final set piece that ranks two to three all time for the franchise. It gets a little dense at times, but its pace and intensity more than cover that. So those are some of just the initial reactions from Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. And again, if you want to see more, there's more of these reactions on Twitter for yourself to go see before the reviews come out in probably just a little bit over a week or so for people to probably check out. But really what this tells me is that, once again, Paramount, Tom Cruise, Christopher McQuarrie, they've done it again, it seems like, with Mission Impossible 7. And I'm excited for this one again. Top Gun was my favorite film of last year. This is one of my most anticipated films of the year, and I've loved the Mission Impossible films throughout. I think they just keep bringing great entertainment. They've recently, with the attachment of Christopher McQuarrie, have told great stories with, I think, amazing twists and turns when you feature in the twists that can come with being a part of the Mission Impossible kind of sequences when they're on these missions and they're pulling off all these impossible tasks. You can kind of pull certain things out and do some really interesting things, and I think McQuarrie just has a great pulse on this franchise right now and what it really should be all about. And then when you add in the factor of Tom Cruise as the ultimate daredevil himself in the stunts that he performs and just bringing it every single time, it's just been a recipe for success. And it seems like overall they've done it again, and so I'm excited for this one. I'm excited for part two next year, and of course I'll have my review for Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 when I see the film in just a couple of weeks. So what did you guys think about the first reactions for Mission Impossible 7? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And the final thing that I want to talk about on the podcast today is a little bit of a release date change that happened earlier today. And it was announced from Universal that the second part of the Wicked films that are set to be released both in 2024 and 2025, the part two is actually set to be moved up in 2025 from December 25th, around the Christmas holiday time, to November of 2025. So it's both films are basically going to be coming out a year apart from one another, November 25th. of 2024, and then November 26th, 27th of 2025 is when part two is coming out. And I think that's a smart move for Universal to do. A, it moves out of the realm of Avatar, which last week Disney postponed Avatar 3 from December 2024 of next year to a year later in 2025. So instead of Wicked Part 1 going up against an Avatar film, the final installment in the two-parter is going to be all going up against the next installment of what is one of the most lucrative franchises in Hollywood right now in the Avatar films. And while it's going to have to face it, it's made sure that it doesn't have to. The last couple of weeks of its run probably only have to face the behemoth known as Avatar. As I think right now in 2025, no one is going to be going around that film whatsoever, as I think they were proven back last year that for an Avatar film, people still go see these films, not just here in the United States, but all over the world. It is a global brand, and I don't think anyone's going to be touching those dates anytime soon. So it made sense for Universal to move it. I still think that these films are actually going to do very, very well. I know the musical aspect, especially after getting burned in 2021 with all those musicals, I thought they would kind of do well. And maybe in a pandemic less year, it would have. I just think that with Wicked, there's a popularity to those, to that film, or not to the film, but to the play. The legacy of Wicked has more so than even something like an In the Heights or a West Side Story, or obviously, of course, a Tick, Tick, Boom. But we'll see how they do. But I think from everything I've seen and heard about this film, it's going really, really well. They're still in the midst of production right now, but I'm really excited to see what they're delivering. And again, I think it was a smart move for them to move away from Avatar 3 and move to November. I think if they do well in November 2024, it'll give them confidence to say, we still got to the right date. It's right after the Thanksgiving break. It's still within that holiday corridor. And I think it fits very well for both parts of Wicked to come out at those times as well. So what do you guys think about Wicked Part 2 moving up from December 2025 to November 26th of 2025? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And with that down and out of the way, that will do it for this edition of the Sam Basel Podcast. Once again, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. Be sure to check out my channel for more content. You can check me out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Radio Public, SoundCloud, and much more. Also, make sure to tune in on to the Ambiguous Podcast Solutions, and be sure to check out the other amazing shows that are on here, such as You Mad Bro, the number one source to see what the internet is pissed off about on a weekly basis. Also, make sure to check out Goal Driven Professionals, geared toward improving client relations, return on investment, and customer acquisition costs for independent businesses and services. Also, make sure to check out The Daily Grind, a weekly motivational podcast with Kelly Johnson, giving you everyday tips and key takeaways on reaching your goals. Also, along the way, make sure to check out these other amazing shows on the Podcast Solutions, such as Wrestle Attic Radio, Fretzelmania Podcast, and Midnight Showing. You can check these out and so much more on the website, ambiguouspodcastsolutions.com. Also on Facebook and Twitter at Real Ambiguous. And if you want to check out Canopy Treehouse, use the coupon code AMBIGUOUS. Also, when you get a chance, make sure to follow me on social media. You can find me on Twitter at Basel Samuel. That's BUSSELLSAMUEL. And also on Facebook at Sam Basel. Once again, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. And until next time, keep on screening.